Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as a specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Welcome to the Pitchfork Review. I'm Pooja Patel, the editor of Pitchfork. So every year, Pitchfork's year-end lists are this totally massive undertaking where we try to nail down the best music of the year. It's a dizzying process that involves the entire staff, input from critics who write for the site, hours and hours and hours of revisiting music, and many debates and discussions between our editors and writers. To give you a little bit of context here, Pitchfork reviews over 1,000 new albums on the site each year, which feels completely mind-boggling. And a lot of those albums have even more songs that we really love. On top of that, there's all of the stuff that we might have missed or covered in a different way on the site. So it's a ton of music to consider overall. Today, we thought it would be fun to bring some of the debates that we're having behind the scenes and on Slack here to the podcast. Here with me is our reviews editor, Jeremy Larson, and our contributing editor, Andy Cush.
Hey, Pooja.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, you know, it's going okay. Not great. Feeling the high of the election results and now the new low of the insanity that has followed it.
We thought we were okay for a couple days, and now it's straight back to the weirdness.
I'm riding a dopamine roller coaster, just hanging on for dear life, just seeing what kind of chemicals my brain is sending out and just kind of going with it, really.
Well, and then on top of that, you know, return back to work, and we're in the midst of making a million year-end lists.
Yeah, so I'm not quite as close to the center of that process as you guys are. I've done a little bit of writing of blurbs, and there's some editing that I'm pitching in with. But as far as the actual process of choosing the records and songs that end up on the main year-end list, that's still kind of a mystery for me, and I work for Pitchfork. I was wondering if you guys could explain to me, and also to our listeners, a little bit about what music ends up on the list.
Yeah, I could bring you into the fold. Come on in.
Thanks.
The water's warm.
The water's acid.
The water is like 7.8 to 7.9 warmth level.
That is correct. Before the list is even made, we review thousands of albums a year. And, you know, they are all critiqued. Some of them we give best new music because they kind of speak to what's happening in the year, or that particular artist is doing something unique inside of that genre. Or it's just kind of something that we can't really all put our finger on just yet, but we all know that we really like it. So we look at, obviously, is it doing something new with the sound? Is it an especially well-written album? Is it composed really well? You know, is it like using technology in an interesting way? Does it have something to say about the past, the present, the future? Is it exciting? You know, those are some of the questions that we ask ourselves, you know, when we're considering sort of what we like throughout the year. And that process is, it's always sort of on the top of our mind as we're sort of considering what is going to be some of the best albums of the year. And then, you know, when we get to the year end, we sort of take these thought processes that have been happening since January and we try to condense them into a list. And I think Pooja can talk more about how that happens.
Yeah, I think that everything that you said is a crazy way to try to distill any sort of score or ranking. And then yet we have tasked ourselves with that nonetheless.
It's an inherently absurd thing, but we do it nonetheless, because it makes it easier to understand and it makes it easier to communicate like what we want.
Totally.
I think like that's also part of the fun of it. It is nothing if not really fun.
Yeah. I think that one of the big challenges for all of us is that it is just so much music to consider. And then add to that, that there are 25 to 30 people on staff who love music. And so at the end of the year, we are considering a ton of music that we truly deeply love across a lot of genres made in lots of different ways with lots of different resources. There is so much to consider about what we want to say as a site when we are making these lists. So I think that taking what we do on an album or a song level and trying to apply it to a large swath of things, it does rely on, does this feel important to this year? Does it feel like it moved a genre forward? Does it feel like it's best in class compared to its peers? Does it feel exciting and innovative and fresh? Does it feel like 10 years from now, people are going to look back at this collection of music and say, that feels essential. All of the albums and all of the songs that they put on there feel essential. Are we being inclusive of taste? Have we considered all of the genres that we cover? Have we considered the opinions and perspectives of the experts on staff and the experts in our contributor pool? And also, does it feel moving to us personally? We have all of these massive considerations that are super earnest and involve varying pools of people listening to music and discussing it for hours on end and then making critical claims about them. And then also sometimes it just comes down to us having this conversation where we are arguing about which song is better.
One fun way we have been litigating these questions that I have been privy to, we'll have these big Zoom listening sessions where staffers and contributors will attend, and we'll kind of do a slightly more formalized version of passing the aux cord and everyone playing their kind of favorite songs of the year or from a particular genre. And it's a way to acquaint yourself with some stuff you might have missed, learn about your peers and friends' taste, and sort of just have a more well-rounded appreciation of the year's music going into this year-end period. And I guess it was maybe last Friday, sort of in conjunction or after one of these sessions, Pooja started putting pairs of songs in Slack and saying, okay, Bill Callahan's Pigeons versus Bill Callahan's The Mackenzies. If you think this song is better, you know, put your emoji here. If you think this song is better, put your emoji here. And it was like a very kind of quick fire, quippy way of being to inform these decisions, as I understand it.
I want to put a disclaimer on that. I think that the point of that and this is also to react with your gut. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes you can circle around an argument for so long, and especially when it's music that is legitimately good and you legitimately care about, you can make the case for either for as long as possible. So part of what we try to do also is just kind of like rapid fire, speak from your heart, choose one or the other, let's go. That's what we're going to do today. The three of us will take turns making our case for some of our favorite music from this year. We'll run through a list of a few artists that I like to call Pitchfork core artists. They're primarily, though not exclusively, indie artists who are beloved by the staff, who have been best new music artists this year with albums that we really enjoyed that also had multiple really great songs on them. And whenever this happens, we like to try to consider some of the album highlights immediately next to one another. It's a brutal task. But the idea is to shed some light on what we do when we have way more good music than we can include. To start, Jeremy, let's you and I square off with one of the biggest music figures of 2020 in my mind, Phoebe Bridgers. It feels like, to me personally, the big single from Punisher, which is Phoebe's release, was Garden Song. Her first single from that album had a big impact, very popular. However, I know that, Jeremy, you have a different fave.
Yeah, I love Garden Song. I mean, this is Phoebe Bridgers' big year. I mean, I think she is clearly one of the artists who took the biggest leap from a kind of indie songwriter to a person on Twitter who has a modest stan army, which, you know, is always really a respectable facet of one's career. I think this album is spectacular. There really isn't a bum song on it. And I love Garden Song. I mean, this is sort of part of the joy and pain of doing this, is that you kind of have to Sophie's Choice your way through a lot of this.
Yeah, the big disclaimer is that we love all of the songs, and that inherently is the problem.
The song for me on this album is the final song, which I think she released as a single later on. It's called I Know the End.
Somewhere in Germany, but I can't place it. Man, I hate this part of Texas. Close my eyes, fantasize. Three clicks and I'm home.
I think it's kind of a cliche to wish for the end of things as like a defense mechanism for like some stress in your life. If you're having a bad day, you're just like, oh, I just want to end it all. But I think there's something interesting about Phoebe Bridgers having like a premonition about the end. And I think that's sort of like an interesting lens twist on it. And that felt especially potent this year. It's not that just like, I want it to end, but it's the feeling of like, this is going to end, right? This is all, we're in the end game. None of this is going to last. I think that to me is a feeling that really stuck with me. You know, a lot of her songs, she writes in past tense a lot as like a dream and the past and nostalgia. That's like something she's very good at. And it's cool to sort of contrast that with something like this that kind of has this feeling of heading towards oblivion, you know?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, I'm just like a sucker for a buildup. That just gets me every time. And the song has this huge buildup right at the very end. And she has this line that's like, I'll find a new place to be from, a haunted house with a picket fence to float around and ghost my friends. I love that. I think it's cool.
I do feel like what you have going for you here is that buildup, is like the very full catharsis closing out the album.
Oh, yeah. It's like cheating almost.
Yeah.
You know?
So that's like, the thing, is that it's cheating. Like, if we're going to talk about Phoebe as a songwriter and how freaking deft and skilled she is as a songwriter, it has to be Garden Song. For me, I just feel like you said, like she's super sardonic and she has the ability to be kind of sarcastic and sweet in the same breath. So you don't even notice it, which is just like an incredible skill to have. But I think that the opening of that song, the opening verse, just is so bracing.
Someday I'm gonna live in your house up on the hill.
Like, she sets this entire scene up. Once I buy this house up on the hill, your skinhead neighbor might go missing.
And when your skinhead neighbor goes missing, I'll plant a garden.
Big wink there. And then immediately contrast the idea of like planting a garden to cover up like something that possibly very tragic happened involving a hateful person. And then completely like killing the flowers. I'm gluing them to the float now. Like, she has this cycle of kind of like death and life and pairing them immediately next to each other in a way that makes it feel so kind of cosmic. And also, like, in that exact same verse, two lines later, she talks about her house burning down, except for the notches in the doorpost, which is, I think, a literal reference to her parents' divorce happening around the same time her childhood home caught on fire.
I grew up here till it all went up in flames, except the notches in the door frame.
And having that sit next to the idea of being nostalgic about childhood and growing up, and then like propelling yourself into adulthood where you can buy the house on the hill and you can murder your skinhead neighbor and make something beautiful out of it, to me is just like stunning writing. And then I think also the fact that that song is so stripped down, it's like very beautiful and shimmering and never reaches climax and still can be so emotive and evocative and jarring. Ugh, incredible song. My vote is Garden Song.
Okay, well, as someone who has not listened to the Phoebe Bridgers album at all, I'm going to go and try to be an objective judge of this debate of sorts.
Wait, Andy, you haven't listened to it at all?
No. I've been so bad. That said, of those two descriptions, Garden Song sounds like the one I want to hear first.
Did I mention that there's a horn section that comes in and I know
it's too late? You had your time on the floor.
What about this? She starts screaming at the end. Just screaming.
I sort of had that in my head with
the
catharsis
mic
idea. But the thing that appeals to me in Pooja's argument for Garden Song is that lack of catharsis, the restraint, the withholding, and the ambiguity, which feels to me sort of indicative of the state of things in a way that's easier for me to apprehend than this kind of big blowout climax. I feel like my year has felt like one non-climax after another, and I'm interested in something that might want to explore that kind of middle ground.
For what it's worth, Jeremy, I really thought you could win that one.
What are you talking about? You had an essay. You had like a dissertation on Garden Song.
So another artist and album that I want to talk about is Destroyer's Have We Met, which I know we keep joking about feels like it came out a million years ago simply because it came out in January, which was an entirely different world than the one that we are living in now. The album still holds up. It's so good. I know that Jeremy and Andy, you both have differing takes on what is the best track. Andy, I'm going to start with you. What's your player?
Yeah, so this album came out in January, and I'm a longtime Destroyer fan. I remember the first single from this record was Crimson Tide, and for some reason, upon hearing that, I was not that interested in it. It didn't feel like the right thing for me at the time. I was ready to be underwhelmed. And that ended up not being the case at all with the album. And the third single was this song called Q Synthesizer, which completely blew me away. Like, first listen on the day it came out, it had this amazing, almost like Tarkovsky-esque music video. And the whole package was just so holistic and moving.
Did you realize it was hollow? Like everything that's come before, you are gone.
I was talking about enjoying ambiguity before. I think Dan Behar, who is the songwriter of Destroyer, is sort of the king of these like unresolved feelings, songs that kind of work by suggestion and implication and just kind of throwing evocative images next to each other without ever really explaining to you what they mean. For the last like 10 years or so, also kind of giving you the sense that he's sort of wandered into his own songs and he's taken aback by this kind of decaying luxury of the sounds around him. And there's this kind of meta commentary offered by him about his own music and songwriting. And part of the reason that Q Synthesizer blew me away is because he's taking that kind of aspect of being this sort of befuddled observer of his own music to another more literal degree, where he's like literally saying Q Synthesizer, like as if he's talking to the band to try to get the music going, then Q guitar, Q drums. And as our colleague Sam Sadomsky pointed out, like when he is making those cues, the things aren't even happening. So he's like kind of setting up this surreal dream situation where he can't even seem to wrestle control of his own music.
Q guitar. Fake drum.
That is such a singular atmosphere and feeling for a song to convey. And though I loved that whole album, the particular dynamic that he sets up in Q Synthesizer felt like the clear pinnacle to me.
He is just like the most endearing guy alive. But Jeremy, what's your pick?
I think it's The Raven, which is a shorter song on the album. And I think it probably is a more throwback Destroyer song, whereas Q Synthesizer kind of fits more into the mold of the record. Watching Dan Behar is kind of like watching a magician. And you just sort of, it's like watching him like do close-up magic. There he has this like patter and you're like, the patter doesn't really mean anything, but it's like what he's doing. And it's all like the misdirection that he gives you. And all of a sudden he hits you with this line that feels like it was conjured from a different dimension. And like when he sings the dead twist and shout in the invisible world, the grand old Opry of death is breathless. And then he just like repeats breathless, breathless. It's just, I cannot describe the feeling other than like when I'm watching a guy like tell me that I was actually thinking about the Seven of Clubs and I was right.
The dead twist and shout in an invisible world. The grand old Opry of death is breathless. Breathless.
It's as if he like gets inside my head. But the other thing I really like about this record and the song in particular is that a lot of music I've found this year have made me like think about what I'm feeling. And I always find with Dan Behar and Destroyer is that it makes me think about him and like who this guy is and why he's writing and singing this way.
Just look at the world around you. Actually, no, don't look. But if you only knew how I cry foul every hour of every day, well, I hope you've enjoyed your stay.
It's such an interesting perspective as a songwriter, because I'm not like scrawling these lyrics in my notebook and circling them and like putting them as aim away messages. It's more just sort of watching someone work and being really fascinated by it. I think what The Raven leaves me with, and that's more of a macabre song than I think Q Synthesizer is. Although I do think this record is pretty dark and has a lot of
death themes
to it.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of like what I just really like about The Raven, you know?
Yeah.
Q Synthesizer also has that line that is my favorite line, where he says, the idea of the world is no good. That's maybe one I would leave as an aim away message. So I really do like, now I'm just arguing for Q Synthesizer. So
guess that means I won.
Yeah, I do like that. It seems like a thematic impulse that's being triggered in both of us is to be like, well, your song is actually also maybe as good. So the next one that I want us to talk about is a matchup between two songs from what is one of my favorite albums of the year, Moses Sumney's Gray. That was just an odd kind of release this year because it was released in two parts with, I want to say, 4 months between them.
Pre-pandemic and post-pandemic too. Like,
yeah, exactly. And it's very long as an album in two parts also. And there are these great kind of skits and interludes in it. And it's a very rich experience, which makes it even harder, I think, for us to pick the one song that will outwin or outfight the other. For me, the one from this album is Cut Me. Though, Jeremy, I know that you don't agree.
Okay, let me just talk about Me in 20 Years for a second. The thing that I love most about Moses Sumney is his voice. And I'm not alone, clearly. I'm not uncovering something, some secret part of his art. But I think the amount of time he spends in his falsetto on Me in 20 Years, and it's this song about like fearing being alone. To me, it's like, it's either something really protective or something really vulnerable. And I can't really figure out which one it is, because I'm not sure if he feels more comfortable singing such in a high falsetto, or if he feels more comfortable just maybe singing without it. I'm not really sure. But I find that juxtaposition to be really moving in the song. And then he does this thing, the bridge of the song is where he's just sort of singing a little bit more, but you know, up three octaves. And he hits this like blue note just before he comes back into the chorus, the third chorus. And he does this a lot in Cut Me Too, and where he'll find a way to slide between two notes. And the journey between those two notes is always exhilarating, because he mm-hmm. does it with his voice. And his voice is so good and so in control. It's just not something we're used to hearing anymore.
Yeah.
And I think just to experience the range in Me in 20 Years is the reason I always just go back to his music and go back to this album a lot.
I think that what you were saying about the falsetto and living in that falsetto space is so impressive and very real. And it definitely shows up on Cut Me too. What I really like about that song, and I'm a little bit biased here as well, because Moses Sumney was the last live show I saw before the pandemic, and there were no cameras or phones allowed, and the air conditioning was off. So it was kind of muggy. Everyone was a little bit nervous that they might have COVID because they were all sweating. And there was this stripped down kind of no distractions performance led by one of the greatest contemporary voices right now in my mind. But I wanted to paint that picture because I feel so often it can feel like Moses Sumney is kind of sitting at this musical pulpit. Like he is a preacher of sorts. And Cut Me in particular is this like very vibrant song, but it is so subtle in that it has these different elements that come in and out of it. And you can almost imagine like friends stopping by in the song. Like you kind of hear this blustering trumpet come in and then like kind of noodle off, and then you hear these like really slow keys come in and then noodle off. And it really feels like every part of that song is in service to him and what he needs in that moment, you know? But also, you're so right. It harkens back to this kind of like OG Motown R&B. That opening bass line of that song feels almost as instantaneously classic to me as like the bass line of The Temptations' My Girl, where as soon as you hear it, you know what you're in for. You know? To consider all of that, and then to also know that it's a song that feels kind of joyous and warm and opening, but the running through line and sentiment of it is, it might not be healthy for me, but what I need is what cuts me.
Might not be healthy for me, but seemingly I need. What cuts me, cuts me, cuts me, cut me, cut me, cut me.
It's incredible that this song has such a sinister undercurrent, but sounds really warm and kind of fun and hooky and catchy. And to me, that song feels like the single because it actually delivers the sentiment of what it's getting at. Like, in pain, there's pleasure. He is singing fully about how he's a masochist, but the sound of it is fully like warm and engaging and joyful. So he's kind of achieved the premise of the song in its existence, in my mind.
Damn. I was totally ready to side with Jeremy, but you took me over to your side with that amazing kicker to your argument.
Yeah, and that song has horns too, so what can you say?
Also, like, Moses has the range. Me in 20 Years is so vastly different from Cut Me.
Yeah,
totally.
That was a tough pairing, because he just does have the range, as they say.
Okay, so this next one is really hard. Two songs from Waxahachie's incredible album, Saint Cloud. The songs are Fire and Lilacs. Andy, Lilacs is your favorite, right?
Yeah. I will start by offering the requisite at this point disclaimer that I think Fire is a wonderful song too. But if
I thought you were going to say that you haven't listened to this album.
I'm just making it up as I go along. No, this was music that I did listen to. Yeah, Lilacs is definitely my favorite song on the album. One of the things that I like about it is, okay, you have this amazingly catchy chorus that if it were sort of surrounded by different musical elements could be like a top 40 pop melody, but instead is delivered in this kind of, you know, rootsy, country-ish Americana instrumental world. And as you get to the end of this chorus, Katie Crutchfield immediately propels you into like a second hook that you don't expect to be there, which is this like, ooh, which is like...
Wait, how does that go? How does that go again?
You heard me the first time.
Ooh, I need your love too.
So she's doing this wordless ooh thing, which is like one of my favorite songwriting kind of flexes, where you like kind of hit someone with an amazing chorus and then like go straight into almost like a second chorus that is just as powerful and catchy as the one that you just finished. After this great second hook, she kind of hits you with an unexpected minor chord. You sort of expect the song to go somewhere else. And then she says this nice ambiguous line, I need your love too, and you're kind of straight back into the verse. That to me is just so satisfying. Like the way the construction of the song plays out compared to Fire, and I think the looseness of it allows her to be a little more expressive with what she does with her voice, especially in the outro when she's just kind of repeating this titular line in the Lilacs Drink the Water. And every time she says it, she inflects it a little differently. And that is just one of those kind of like hair-raising, just very beautiful moments of that album to me. And yeah, I like Lilacs.
It is crazy how the style of her voice is just incredible.
Yeah. And especially like if you go back and listen to like P.S. Eliot, her first band, or even like early Waxahachie albums, like, which are great, but her voice is just so like arresting and forceful now in a way that it even wasn't like back then. She's like really, it's just really grown in an amazing way.
Yeah. Jeremy, you wrote that album review, right?
Yeah. I remember writing that because it was right when we were in lockdown, like when we very much started lockdown in New York.
I also remember you texting me as you were listening to it, being like, this is helping.
Yeah, it was, it's such a, does have very a springtime feel to it, because I think it's very much about, not maybe not new love, but there's a lot of love in this album. But there's a lot of darkness too, you know, that's what, why I think like I may be partial to Fire, but I'd be curious what Pooja has to say about the song.
I feel like this is a truly no skips album. For me, I think Fire is one of the songs I've listened to most this year, for what it's worth, but it so viscerally takes you to a place and time for me. Like, it feels like a turnkey in a fantasy novel to exactly what she's doing, which is driving in a car with the person she loves as she's watching the sunset.
That's what I wanted. It's not as if we cry. Memphis is on fire in the light of day.
What I thought was really kind of endearing and charming about it was she was in the car with her boyfriend watching the sunset outside of Memphis, and the lyrics came to her and she was almost embarrassed to talk about it with him or write it in his presence, and had to kind of hide from him as she worked on it, which I think is just such a like really sweet way to think about the person you love. Like, I am feeling such a strong connection to you that it feels too fragile to even exercise it in front of you.
And I take off driving past places been tainted. I put on a good show for you.
And I almost feel like that sentiment is present right from the jump. The song begins, in my mind, in the middle of a thought. It's like she is having a thought, like a stream of consciousness feeling or something, and then just starts to speak it out loud in real time. You can tell she's like kind of nervous and on edge, and morphs it into something that's like super self-assured and super powerful. When the song flips into that part that goes, and I take off driving past places been tainted to put on a good show for you, it starts from this place of insecurity. And then by the end of the verse, she gets to a part where she says, I'm wiser and slow and attuned. And it's almost like you can feel her kind of restlessness being morphed into this place of security and love. And that sentiment is just really, really powerful to me. You know, we have a bunch of contributors and the staff vote between songs, and I have been caping for this song internally. Everyone here can attest to me saying Waxahachie Fire is the best Waxahachie song. And when all of the votes came in for this round of year-end voting, Fire and Lilacs were immediately next to each other by the votes, with Fire ranking higher, but Lilacs with one vote more, which I find extremely telling and kind of why this debate is so hard, you know?
Which for our listeners at home, imagine sort of like a popular vote versus electoral college thing, maybe. There's like two different sort of metrics we're working off of here that were slightly different.
Yeah, there's a big group of contributors outside of Pooja's apartment holding up signs that say voter fraud right now.
Count all votes.
It's pretty disturbing.
Yeah, and the ones who are standing for Fire are the ones that are chanting, stop counting. Okay, well, with that, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back in a little bit and go at it again.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to the Pitchfork Review. I'm Pooja Patel, and I'm here with our reviews editor, Jeremy Larson, and contributing editor, Andy Cush. And today, we're talking through some of our favorite songs of the year. Let's move on to a different kind of less sentimental, less inward-facing album this year, which was Jesse Ware's What's Your Pleasure? Full of energy, full of kind of dance vibes. I know that this is another one where Jeremy and I pretty strongly disagree on what the best track from the album is. Jeremy, what is your go-to?
Jesse Ware said that Spotlight was directly influenced by sort of, especially the intro was directly influenced by jazz and musical theater. So it's of course, I'm going to like this. This song is takes elements of Janet Jackson and puts it into this giant ballroom and just sort of lets it all kind of move around in this enormous space. The craftsmanship behind Spotlight, I think, is so perfect. The way she sings in this sort of syncopated voice and the way she uses the rhythm of her voice. You know, I don't think there's very much to the song, except for it's very sort of traditional. I don't know. It feels like someone is just sort of you're at a very loud club and someone's just sort of whispering to you in the ear. And that's sort of what I like about the vibe of this. Mm-hmm. And there's something kind of sad about it, too, which I think kind of goes back to some of her earlier stuff. But, you know, the hook is so good when she just says, I just want to stay in, the moonlight. It's our time, spotlight. The other thing that I really like about it is that one of my sort of earliest imprints of loving pop music is when Blue Cantrell's song Hit 'Em Up Style came out and whatever in 2001. And you know, at the end of that song where she's she does that sort of thing at the very end. Everybody's nodding and agreeing with me. It's great. But Jessie Ware does the thing in the chorus. She's it's such this cool, there's so many cool vocal ideas about the song. I think the way I think about the song is a little more heady than just sort of hits me in the feels. But I guess that's probably why I kind of like this song, because I find there's so many interesting choices about it. And yeah, that's Spotlight for me.
Yeah, I think Spotlight is a fantastic song. Don't get me wrong here. One thing that I just like about this album in general is that it's a little bit of a step left from what Jesse Ware usually does. Mm. And when you think of Jesse Ware, you do think of beautiful, rich R&B vocals. You think of the kind of quiet intimacy and the whispering in your ear, as you put it, Jeremy. You know, her biggest songs, Tough Love or Wildest Moments or Say You Love Me, they all kind of have that really light intimacy to them. So I think for me, what I really love about this album as a whole is that it feels like she is really stepping into the spotlight.
Whew.
and owning it. You know what I mean? This is a no holds back dance album, dance pop album. And one thing that I love is that she said that she wanted to make an album to have sex to. So she basically was just this isn't about flirtation anymore. I'm done with being coy.
She wanted, I have to interrupt. She wanted to make an album that she herself could have sex to?
No. For other people to have sex
to. Oh, okay. Got it.
I just love the idea of this woman who has had this cult underground fandom behind her, who's made incredible music for so long, saying kind of brazenly, I want to make an album about sex and I want people to be turned on by it. And I want you to feel like you want to be in the club and get it on with someone. And that, for that reason, the title track, What's Your Pleasure, is my kind of song, because it's not the hint of possibility anymore. It's not the hint of longing. It's an embrace of feeling lust.
Make a wish, blow out my candle.
has, you know, the disco sentiment behind it. It has very strong Studio 54 like evocation in it. But at the same time, it's like her channeling her kind of Donna Summer Love to Love You or I Feel Love moment and being like, all right, let's get after it. And for me, that makes the song so fun, especially being a longtime fan of Jessie Ware's.
Yeah, this is her Grown and Sexy album.
Totally.
It has that vibe. I do think the title track feels like more of a club song, whereas the Spotlight feels more like a ballroom song. Like if we're trying to really taxonomize the Jessie Ware of this.
It's for the gentle folk.
Yeah, exactly. For the Jeremy Larson. For the coattails and the long dresses and the chiffon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The tulle, all of that.
Mm-hmm. The last thing that I wanted to talk about is kind of the what I'm going to call the fan faves. And so I wanted us to maybe cape for a fave that we want to see on the list that might be from a lesser known band or something that was kind of a really refreshing best new music or a rising artist in your mind, or maybe just like a surprising artist in your mind.
Yeah, I'll go first. I think one of my favorite debuts of this year is by this guy named Barty Strange. His album is this mix of kind of like rock and R&B and hip hop and emo. There's this moment in an artist's career before they get too in their head and start thinking about who they are and what they want to be. And you just get this splatter of everything they've have been influenced by and have loved up until that point. You know, it's like that, you know, how you say you spend the first 40 years of your life writing your debut novel. Like that's what like a really great debut album feels like. It's just sort of this expulsion of ideas. And that's what you get with Barty Strange. And I think my favorite song off of that is a song called Mustang, which is really kind of him just going for the rafters. You get a sense of his range as like a vocalist and as a songwriter. I think Mustang is the name of the town that he grew up in.
Yes, that's correct.
And so you kind of, there's all this imagery about, you know, horses, obviously, but it's also kind of about leaving home and finding a new place to go. And, you know, I don't know, just a killer song. And, you know, you put it on and you kind of wish that you were just in a room with other people hearing it. And this is definitely one of those ones for me where I wish Barty Strange could have had a year to tour this album and, you know, gain a bigger audience and keep building because it's so worth hearing. And he's such an artist that it's going to go places. And I feel like I wish I could be here at that moment of his debut because I feel like it would be something special to remember. But Mustang is one of my sneaky favorites.
I think that's such a strong sentiment, Jeremy, to say when you hear a song and you just wish that you were with other people listening to it.
Oh, God, I feel like that all of the time.
The band that I've been listening to a lot recently, I have the opposite feeling with, which is that they are a great kind of loud, angsty band that I cannot wait to see live one day. But at the same time, it's such cathartic music that I just want to listen to it loudly by myself and feel all my feelings. So the band is Parge Radio from Brighton, and the singer Dana Margolin has this incredible capacity to really exercise angst in this dry, very witty, kind of funny way. So there's the song Sweet from the album, which I think is a near perfect song. Super angsty. She's fed up, she's pissed off, and she's kind of embattled in what seems like the classic mother-daughter relationship where where one might feel suffocated or claustrophobic within their parents' love. And she kind of talks about how her mom is nagging her, prodding at her, telling her that she's like not watching what she eats, that she looks unkempt, you know, she should take better care of herself. And at the same time is mirroring back like, I'm a great person. I'm doing well.
My mom says that I look like a nervous wreck because I bite my nails right down to the flesh.
Screaming, I'm fine at your mother feels like a really relatable sentiment, especially right now. But what I really love about it is that it has this really strong kind of like catch and release propulsion to it. Like she's sitting there kind of muttering in this chant-like way about how she is kind and she is sweet and she is charming and she is clever. And then it explodes into these guitars that are doing the screaming for her, you know, and then fully pairs back down to her being like, and you will love me and she will love me when she meets me and she will love me when she meets me and she will love me when she meets me. But yeah, I just love that record, and that song in particular has really resonated. I love you, Mom. This is not a criticism of you. but I think that it really captures that relationship and that tug and pull of that kind of parental child sentiment. Andy, what was yours?
Yeah, so I want to talk about a song from this record that came out just a couple weeks ago on Halloween, and I had the fairly rare experience for me of hearing it for the first time and even probably 10 minutes into it feeling like this is my favorite album of the year now, which is a live album that's just called Live by Angel Bat-David. She is a kind of free jazz clarinetist, composer, keyboard player, vocalist. She had put out one really sweet album called The Oracle that she kind of made all herself, that had this very kind of insular, hermetic quality to it. And on this live album, she's playing with a band, and it is like fully night and day. Like, her first album was quite meditative, and this one is like so intense. It felt like the kind of power wash of my like psyche that I needed going into this election season and like through this slump of COVID. It is not music that is nice to listen to necessarily. If you're not a jazz listener, but you're into like sort of heavy avant-garde rock, I think you could get into it. And the story of this album is really interesting because it was a performance at a jazz festival in Germany where David and her band had these like series of quite racist experiences before the concert. And she sort of confronts the audience for their complacency about racism in really intense ways that kind of are incorporated into the music. And really, it feels like she's like exercising this demon of racism on stage. And it's really something else. And I chose the song London because the album is really a journey front to back. I think the best way to appreciate it is to listen to the whole thing. But London is one song on it that feels sort of standalone, feels maybe a little more approachable than the others. It starts with this kind of minor key melody that just gradually builds to like a total explosion of sound from her clarinet and one of her collaborators' saxophone. It has an intensity and rawness to it that I feel like a lot of new jazz doesn't have. I just love it. I can't recommend it any higher.
One thing I've noticed, I'll just put this out there. Maybe you guys have a response to this. A word that we've used a lot while talking about music is exercise. Like, getting things out and like just finding a way to like get things out of our system, because we don't really have a lot of our normal release systems in place. And I wonder if you think, you know, if we're trying to put a button on the list of this year and like, what does 2020 mean? I wonder if you think that music that either exercised something or allowed us to feel as if we've exercised something in ourselves, like, meant something more to you this year.
Yeah, I think that definitely lands. I think that because it was so much harder to feel normal in most relationships and most interactions, things that either really presented a sense of community or felt like widely accessible landed in a stronger way this year, even internally, even within staff. And then also things that felt like they spoke directly to you and very intimately to you as a person really resonated with people. And I think that has absolutely everything to do with the idea of like exercising a feeling. It feels like therapy.
I feel like what I gravitated to a lot this year was music that kind of like softened my solitude, that like sort of gave me a warm blanket to wrap up in. And part of the reason, which involves this kind of exorcism we're talking about, that this Angel Bat-David album moved me so much, it was like, now it's time to wake the fuck up. You've had your rest, you know, but things are still really bad. And it provided a catharsis that has less to do with, it doesn't really have anything to do with me, but it has to do with like other people's pain and remembering that even though it's easy to retreat into solitude, that things are still very bad in the world and being conscious of that is important.
Yeah. Can I rapid fire ask you a question?
Yeah.
What's your song of the year?
Soccer Mommy, Circle the Drain.
I don't have a good answer for it. Pooja, what's yours?
You did the list. Didn't you do your ballot? What was on your ballot?
I forgot to submit my song's ballot.
God damn it. You guys, do your job. Well, I'm not going to say what mine is, both because I get off on being withholding and also because it might be the same as the year-end list. Number one. Dun, dun, dun. Well, I think that that's a good place for us to end, in part because I'm going to now do this with Jeremy offline for the next several hours, involving 20 to 30 more songs. Thanks, guys, for coming on. This was really fun.
Yeah, this is awesome.
This is really fun. Thanks so much.
If you want to hear the songs that we talked about on this episode, check out our Spotify playlist. It's called The Pitchfork Review, Music from the Podcast. The Pitchfork Review is hosted by me, Pooja Patel. Thanks to Andy Cush and Jeremy Larson for coming on the episode. You can follow Andy on Twitter, @CushAC, and Jeremy, @JeremyDLarson. You can follow me, @Sonari. You can follow Pitchfork on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, @Pitchfork. This episode was produced by Zachariah Hughes and Rufara Mazarura. It was edited by me, Andy Cush, and Zachariah Hughes. Our original music is by Andrew Eben of Basement Crafts. This episode was mixed and scored by Mark Bush. Special thanks to Amy Phillips. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to leave us a review and subscribe to the podcast. You can also send an email to podcast@pitchfork.com with any feedback. Thanks for listening and see you next week.